From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the spring of 1857, U.S. President James Buchanan was determined to deal with the Mormon problem. Reports of disloyalty and official corruption by Mormon leaders prompted Buchanan to appoint a non-Mormon as governor in the territory that Latter-day Saints had made their home. For their part, the Saints weren't that far from the experience of brutal repression, and when Buchanan sent federal troops along to install the new governor, they became defiant and defensive. Brigham Young called the soldiers an armed mercenary mob and declared martial law. In the end, the Utah War didn't become the conflagration it could have been, but it did turn out to be pivotal in the way Mormons interacted with the rest of the world and the other way around. Today on the program, we're telling the stories of the Utah War, so we invite you to join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a great story that comes from the so-called Utah War. In June of 1858, a haggard collection of federal soldiers finally arrived in what was then downtown Salt Lake City. Their mission was to install a new governor and to provide a check to Mormon power. Instead of being greeted by cagey Latter-day Saints, the place was a ghost town, completely empty. Brigham Young had ordered the place evacuated. Young had described the U.S. soldiers as an armed mercenary mob, and he helped lay out this series of scorched-earth tactics and guerrilla offensives. In the end, the Utah War didn't become the conflagration it could have been, but it did turn out to be important historically. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the Utah War. Our guests were Michael Homer with the Utah Historical Society and historians Will Bagley and David Bigler. For all the fascinating stories that come from this incident, David Bigler says it's not an event that's well known, partly because of what else was going on in the country at the time.
The big Civil War occurred just 4 years after. Yeah. It was only 4 years after this that the guns Confederate cannon opened on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor. And it kind of took all the headlines and all the great interest. I think another reason is that there were no pitched battles. So wars are usually identified with pitched battles where you have bodies lying all around.
Yeah.
But it was a war nevertheless. It was between an incompatible theocratic governing system here in Utah, established by the Mormons in 1847, and a United States that had installed in Utah Congress in 1950 a territorial form of government which imposed appointed officials in control over them. And it was, as one early Mormon bishop said, it was a conflict to break the band of Washington, to break the bands of the Gentiles over their system here. So it was a very real war in every sense of the word, and an important one.
Yeah. Will Bagley, why do you think it was important? How significant was the Utah War in the scheme of things, do you think?
Well, it's a tough sale on the national level because it's so overwhelmed by contemporary events. In Utah, it's a defining central conflict, and it in many ways marks the end of Mormon active pursuit of the millennial strategy. When Brigham Young began his confrontations with the government in the 1850s, he was very much a Latter-day Saint. He believed that the millennium was coming, that he would see Jesus, that he would see Joseph Smith raised from the dead. And the policies he pursued were to implement that. And the Mormons in Utah saw the pending conflict as an apocalyptic battle between themselves as the kingdom of God and the American government, which was Babylon.
So this, from the perspective anyway of them at the time, this would have been that moment that would have taken them then to the sort of final end.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And in terms of the national perspective on it, the Mormons had suffered intensely in their short history because they were so different than their frontier neighbors. And They did generate tremendous sympathy because of the abuses they'd suffered. But at the same time, their peculiarities made them an easy target. But in terms of how the war actually transpired, it's a fascinating set of political twists and turns. And at the very end of it, a correspondent named Lemuel Fillmore, who was later killed in the Lawrenceville massacre in the Civil War, is reporting for the New York Herald, and he says, "Thus was peace made. Thus ended the Utah War," which he summarized as being killed none, wounded none, fooled everybody. Among those fooled have been generations of historians, because Utah claimed this story. It became our version of the Lost Cause, and it became foundations for things like the Sagebrush Rebellion.
I wonder, what was the view beyond those elements of sympathy that you got from some? There were, of course, I expect, more suspicious views of Mormons. I'd read A Filthy Nest of Social Vipers, Hissing at All Morality, Defying All Law. How much what was the view from outside based on the officials? What was James Buchanan worried about in this, you know, remote territory in Deseret?
The events leading into the war, the confrontation that led him actually to order U.S. troops to Utah to escort a new governor here to replace Brigham Young. Those events, at first, Buchanan had great support. There was an uproar in Washington over what had happened. Later on, when Brigham Young decided to started the move south to evacuate Salt Lake City, the mood changed nationally overnight. And I think even before that, the mood had begun to change because of the religious implications. Americans have never liked to see people persecuted for their religious beliefs. And by December 1857, Congress was asking Buchanan, just why did you send those troops out there in the first place? And as time went on, the mood changed. And the sympathy then, as I see it, went on the side of the Mormons.
Buchanan makes a very pointed reply to Congress's request, though. And in his statement, annual State of the Union message, basically, he says very forcefully, the Mormons have defied the government, and the record provides substantial verification of that. And Buchanan says, duty demands that we respond to the first rebellion in a state or a territory. And part of the larger consequence of the Utah War is that it traumatizes Buchanan, who was a fairly timid politician to begin with. And when he's confronted with a much, much larger problem in South Carolina, he disgraces himself.
But Michael Homer, does he have a point? I mean, is this political rhetoric? I'm wondering what it was like in the Utah Territory. It's been mentioned it was a sort of theocratic. So was Brigham Young? How much was appointed by Brigham Young? How much democracy was there? And did he have a point? Was there some concern by the federal government in that way?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the Utah War is that it has both a secular side to it and a religious side to it. And in a sense, Buchanan was reacting to what some of the federal judges that had been appointed to the territory said, some of which, like John Fitch Kinney, for example, befriended the Mormons when they were in Utah, and then as soon as he was on his way out, wrote some very, very scathing things about them. Drummond, of course, we all know was not liked by the Mormons when he was here. He didn't like them, and he wrote some scathing things as well. But a guy like Kinney had a little bit more credibility. And so one of the interesting things about this history of the Utah War is that you still have debates going on back and forth, and I suspect that tomorrow, during these sessions of the Utah War at the Historical Society, you're going to have differing perspectives of both the secular and the religious side. And that's what history is all about, and that's why we're glad to be part of it.
Well, David Bigler, did Mormons have a point in their contention that the officials were imposed upon them without due process, that they themselves were corrupt?
I think in most cases that the officials that were appointed here were probably the usual run that you'd find in the territory of the United States. Those who sought these jobs, office seekers, were political cronies of the president. And I think they were not essentially different from others, except perhaps for Judge William Drummond, who came with a prostitute on his arm from Chicago, and sitting at his side also in the courtroom. This really offended everyone's sensibilities here. He probably thought it would be okay because it was a polygamous culture, but he was mistaken, badly mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we should say, Will Bagley, that there's also an important sort of emotional context to talk about. Parley P. Pratt, beloved Mormon leader, is killed around this time, which I expect that the sense of defensiveness and defiance is sort of overheating the emotions in this territory.
Oh, yes. And what's often completely detached from the Utah War is the Reformation. Utah had undergone a religious frenzy. People, Mormons looking back at it, talked about how it's impossible to explain the fanaticism that people took up at the time. And this is a full-on religious revival with a stress on obeying your leaders, living your religion, cleanliness, being rebaptized. And this creates a religious mindset that then ties into the announcement that the army's coming, which Brigham Young uses very deliberately to provoke a war hysteria. And he gets up and essentially says the U.S. Army is going to come in. They'll rape and pillage our wagon trains. They're coming here for booty and beauty. They're going to burn us out and run us away. They're only doing it because of polygamy and because we're righteous. And, in fact, the Army's orders were to establish a military district. This had been done in every place else in the West. And don't mess with the Mormons' domestic institutions. That meant don't mess with polygamy. Frenzy, this mindset, though, is really phenomenal.
But what did and any of you respond to this, if you would? What did the Mormons conceive they wanted for their society at the time? Did they want to be apart from the federal government? You know, a place in of themselves. Did they want to? Were they thinking about being mainstreamed into the American community at that time? What did they want?
A theocratic form of government is one ruled by God through a spokesman on earth.
Yeah,
that's a very absolute system. It cannot coexist with forms of government such as a republic ruled by its people through its elected representatives. It cannot coexist without, in a sense, denying its own superiority. It must prevail. You've heard the old saying, truth shall prevail. Truth must prevail or deny itself. So there was no way that these two systems could exist side by side without conflict. We're seeing that, incidentally, in other parts of the world today.
Well, but what's interesting is the Mormons in 1856 had applied for statehood. They very much wanted to be a state because that would give them the authority to elect their own officials, implement their own laws, particularly on marriage, and it would essentially give them an independent position.
But that vision didn't include very many Gentiles being part of the process, did it? Or I mean, how many non-Mormons were in the territory?
Well, there weren't
at the
a lot, but that's the way democracy works.
Yeah, yeah, no, of course.
In Palestine, we have Hamas taking over. But this would have given them they talked about it as an independent state because of what states' rights meant in the 1850s. Huh. But at the same time, when Congress wouldn't even take up the petition for statehood, Brigham Young said, it's either that or we will declare our independence. And many sources say that's exactly what he does on the 24th of July, 1847.
David Bigler.
Congress, in effect, imposed Washington's thumb on God's kingdom.
Michael Homer, how are you seeing that?
I think that, again, it's for me, it's this particular aspect of Utah history is so interesting because it includes the religious aspects and the secular aspects. And I agree with these gentlemen that some of the better histories of this are only being written now. For instance, we see books coming out by David Bigler and others that that really kind of master this this area.
That's Michael Homer. He's the chair of the Utah Historical Society's Board of State History. David Bigler and Will Bagley are the authors of the book The Mormon Rebellion, America's First Civil War. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the spring of 1857, U.S. President James Buchanan appointed a non-Mormon as governor of the Utah Territory. He was worried about a reaction, so he sent federal troops to keep the peace and to make it clear who was in charge. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the incident which has come to be known as the Utah War. Among our guests was Richard Turley. He's assistant church historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Well, I want to get your perspective, I guess, from a more insider perspective from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. First of all, what do you see as the significance of the Utah War of 57-58?
I think one of the greatest impacts of the Utah War is a kind of reconciliation between the theological views of Latter-day Saints living in Utah, predominantly amongst themselves, and a greater nation that embodied the territory at the time.
Did Latter-day Saints, who were living in this region at the time, did they have it settled what they wanted for their society? That is, did they want to be a part of a broader American community, a broader American democracy, or did they want some of the rights of federalism yet to be, you know, left alone?
They were torn in part because of their background. The Latter-day Saints came to Utah originally when it was not American soil. Mm. It was Mexican soil at the time, and then with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, it became an American possession. When they left the United States originally, they left because they had been driven out and because they felt that the rights of ordinary citizens had never been granted to them. So they left with kind of a love-hate relationship with the United States. On the one hand, many of them were raised in the original 13 colonies of the United States. They've been steeped in American constitutional history. And they love the Constitution of the United States with the rights that it guaranteed on paper. But they had not seen those rights guaranteed in practice, like many other persecuted and abused minorities of the 19th century.
So did they have – so they were torn. But did Brigham Young have a vision of what he – did he want to – I mean, Mormonism is very much part of mainstream American culture these days. But Brigham Young's vision at the time, did he think that they could interact, in fact, with the Gentiles, the rest of this country?
Yes, he did. And in fact, he wanted, as was mentioned earlier in the program, he wanted Utah to become a state. And it's important to remember at this period in American history, the balance between federal and state government had not yet been firmly established as it is today. Notions of popular sovereignty were running high at that time. Those were similar notions that gave rise later on to the Civil War. Who should have the ascendancy when it comes to government? Should it be the local and state governments, or should it be the federal government? That's largely settled today, but in the mid-19th century, when Brigham Young was petitioning for statehood, I think he saw a state that had the opportunity, finally, to guarantee within the boundaries of the United States the rights of the Constitution to the Mormon people.
But do you think – I mean, this question of whether or not the Utah Territory was a theocracy, was it in your mind?
In a practical sense, in many ways it was. I say that because the – population of the state was predominantly Latter-day Saint, and therefore the religious values of the people were reflected in every aspect of government. That's not to say that people who were not members of the church were somehow disenfranchised by that. They did have, you know, the rights of citizenship, but in a population that was overwhelming Latter-day Saint, that culture, of course, appeared in every aspect of life.
I wanted to get you to react to Will Bagley and others' views that this was being seen by some Latter-day Saints of the time as sort of a millennial, an apocalyptic struggle, that this was going to be the clincher that was going to bring sort of bring round to an end the sort of final earthly struggle of this society of civilization. How do you react to that?
Well, Latter-day Saints were avid students of the Bible and other scriptures. And as they read these scriptures, they saw this coming day when there would be a millennial struggle. And many of them at the time did see this as a possibility, as a candidate for that millennial struggle. They talked about it in their speeches. They recorded in their journals. So for some, it did seem that that might be the case. They weren't, all of them, absolutely certain, but they thought that the possibilities were real because this did appear to be a confrontation between the Latter-day Saints and a major world power.
What about the man who really mattered, Brigham Young? Did he see it as that?
Well, Brigham Young was divided. On the one hand, he wanted statehood if he could get it. If he couldn't get it, he figured that an independent nation, if you will, an independent organization would be better in terms of guaranteeing rights to his people. He during this entire period, maintained that if he could obtain statehood, he would prefer that. But yeah, if he couldn't maintain statehood, then he'd have to take the alternative.
But he wanted his people to be recognized as equal citizens. And if that wasn't the case, they'd find their own form of government, I guess. Is that it?
And in many ways, the Utah War characterized the position of minority groups in the 19th century. Hmm. In the 19th century, if you were a member of a minority group and did anything wrong, the response to you would be extraordinarily harsh. If someone in the majority group did something wrong to someone in the minority group, typically the punishment would be minor or non-existent. And to call out the United States Army because of some concerns that had been brought back from Utah by federal officials who had left the territory seemed like an overreaction to people in Utah.
Do you think Brigham Young was sort of exciting the passion, stirring up the sentiment of Latter-day Saints at the time? I mean, that's Will Bagley and others' contentions that he was – the rhetoric that he was saying at the time was, you know, they're coming here to destroy us, destroy our way of life. Do you see it that way?
Well, he really didn't need to do much because the culture of the people and the memory of the people at that time was a memory of facing soldiers. When the Latter-day Saints were in northwestern Missouri in the early 1830s, they were driven out by local militiamen, soldiers. Mm. When they moved to Caldwell County and Davies County, they were driven out of the state of Missouri by militia members, soldiers. When they were in Nauvoo, Illinois, they were driven out of Nauvoo by rogue militiamen, soldiers. So they'd had experiences with soldiers abusing women, beating and killing men, and that experience was enough to tell them that if a group of soldiers were coming unannounced to the territory of Utah, they might just repeat the same types of experiences.
Where do these stories diverge, do you think, among scholars? Where are the points of aside from some of the particulars that I guess you're parsing here now, there is some consensus, I think, but where are the sort of major points of disagreement in these stories, do you think?
Well, I don't know that there are so much points of disagreement as points of emphasis.
Huh.
I think most historians today use a modern approach that tries to look at the evidence from a lot of different perspectives. And ordinarily when there are differences, it's when historians are focusing on a particular aspect from a particular point of view historically and then talking about those different points of view. Generally, when they sit down together and talk about the differences, if they agree that there are differing points of view, then really there's a considerable amount of consensus.
There's a really good question that comes from Al, who's been waiting in Salt Lake. Al, sorry for the wait. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is real interesting because it seems like there was a truce called, but we never did this so-called war never got resolved because it looks like the U.S. did come in and totally trash Utah eventually, because now, as Brigham Young prophesied, you can't tell a black leg from a saint. Walking down the street, you can't even tell if somebody's a Mormon or not because they just the same bare tummies, the same baggy pants, the same, bad attitude, the same horrible music at the stoplights cranked up way beyond any ability to listen to it. And it looks like they've sort of won it. So I'm wondering if, we call the truce, but the problem is still there. I'm wondering if, because as John Taylor forecast, that New York will become a pile of rubble and all these other cities will go down, the whole country will collapse, maybe God is going to have to take over because the Mormons lost so badly that somebody's going to have to come along and kind of make it up for them so that they will have a chance to be themselves again.
Wow.
Instead of just being, you know, part of a big culture, kind of a megalithic culture that's kind of an international conspiracy to take over the world with American sort of products and big corporations and so on, and just you know, push everybody into a corner, kill them if they don't agree. I mean, now we're not doing it in Utah, but we'll go someplace else and do it.
Yeah.
If they don't buy our stuff. And so I'm wondering if maybe that's going to have to be the only way that this this difference can be resolved. Of course, we'll have to get the Mormons to come back to being themselves again. I don't know if that'll happen, but what do you guys think?
There's a lot in there, statements, and I think I'm getting maybe the question is, who won in the sort of broadest sense, Richard Trillo? You want to respond to that?
Well, I think in many ways, America won. If there had been a major confrontation, I don't think either side would have come out 100% a victor in this case. After the army came through Salt Lake City on June 26, 1858, Brigham Young received messages from his men that he had posted in the city to tell what the reaction of the military was at that time. To the credit of Albert Sidney Johnston, who was heading this military group, he kept the troops absolutely in line. He would not allow them to brook discipline. And for that reason, Brigham Young was impressed.
Now, he was expecting – well, I don't know what he was expecting, but is it true that word was if they fell out of rank and so much as touched a peach in a Mormon orchard, the place was to be burned to the ground?
They were ready to light Salt Lake City on fire. Not only did they – not do that, but they also were quite impressed by the discipline of the troops. And during the time that the troops remained in Salt Lake City before they left because of the Civil War, the discipline imposed by Albert Sidney Johnston kept this broiling circumstance from, again, erupting into a major fire. And I think we have to credit Johnston for that.
Well, so that brings us to this finally, Richard Turley. This gave I've been using the word cagey, but suspicious, uneasy, traumatized Latter-day Saints an opportunity to see a different view of people who weren't of their faith. Did it help them in the end? And what was the effect ultimately when the troops were stationed here? What effect did it have on Mormons here and, I guess, maybe even vice versa?
The Mormons who were here in Utah at the time provided a lot of the supplies for the military. Some supplies were carted all the way across the plains, but others were provided locally here, particularly fresh fruits and vegetables that couldn't be transported very well. And there was interaction. Not all the interaction between the soldiery and the citizens was a tense interaction. There were people who interacted well. There were soldiers who married Mormon girls and stayed in the territory. All in all, when the troops left in the period before the Civil War, the Mormons benefited because the army sold off at a very inexpensive price a lot of the supplies that they had carted out here. And I think economically at least, the Saints benefited. And the interaction, of course, was an opportunity to interact with people who were different from them in a context which sometimes was tense but sometimes was not.
So you think it changed their view of the outside world, that they maybe could coexist?
Well, I think that view changed progressively over time. The completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in May of 1869 brought an influx of outsiders. But there had always been a stream of outsiders. You know, beginning with the gold rush, Salt Lake really was the crossroads of the West, and people were streaming through, and there were a lot of people who were different from the Latter-day Saints coming through the territory. And at times there were good reactions, at times there were not.
That's Richard Turley. He's assistant church historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation about the Utah War. We were joined by Richard Turley, who is now the assistant historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Also with us were the historians Will Bagley, David Bigler, and Michael Homer. When did the Mormons first know the army was on its way?
Word had reached the frontier by early June that the army was making preparations for Utah. Brigham Young had absolute confirmation probably by the end of June. And because of his desire to dramatically frame the event, they put together a celebration for the 10th anniversary of Brigham Young's arrival in Salt Lake on July 24th, 1857, and had a huge party with selected important people and very dramatically announced the events there.
Well, now, as I heard it, a group of horsemen came running in as if they had just learned the – is that true? Was it staged like that?
Porter Rockwell and A.L. Smoot arrived and brought word that it was definite the Army was on the way. But it was only confirmation of what Young knew already.
He had already known that.
And I think the important point to realize there is that the Saints knew that the Army was coming, but this report said – we have eyewitnesses saying that these trains are headed west. It would be kind of like saying bird flu is on its way to America, but then having the confirmation it's reached San Francisco.
Hmm. Steve is in Orem, Utah. He's been waiting. Sorry for the wait, Steve. Welcome.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
All right. I just had a question on the practice of polygamy. And when did it start and when did it end?
Started in ancient times and it's still going on.
Well, practiced in the Mormon religion.
All right. Are you saying how did it bear on the Utah War in that sense?
Well, just my understanding is a lot of people were sore at the Mormons for practicing this polygamy, and younger women were being sucked into this, and it was upsetting a lot of people. It wasn't like we just attacked these people. You know, there was a precursor to why we were doing that, or why the federal government did the things they did.
Well, Steve, glad you called. It's a good question. Did it have? I mean, it must have. Clearly, the practice of polygamy had an effect on the way outsiders were looking at the territory.
Polygamy was never a great PR point for the Mormons, and in fact, it did create a lot of moral outrage and hostility. However, the igniting factors of the Utah War were not a crusade to put down polygamy. Because, again, the Army was
specifically... They said, leave the domestic stuff alone.
Yeah. And the conflict was more political in many ways. A lot of the... the political conflict between the authorities over who's going to run Utah. But at the same time, the political atmosphere put the Mormons at a disadvantage because polygamy was so unpopular. So
David Bigler, as these troops are on their way here, Brigham Young and his military leaders start putting together what seems to me, at least as an observer, some fairly brilliant strategic tactical maneuvers, some scorched earth policy, some guerrilla tactics. Was there a kind of a strategy that they were getting at? They didn't want to... Go ahead.
There was an exact strategy. It had been determined in advance. The strategy was to keep them out in that fall in 1857. And if they were overwhelmed in 1858, it was to move from here to another location.
That's a big question. Move temporarily or get out for just
move
the time?
Move permanently.
More permanently.
Yes. The strategy then was to keep them out during that fall. This would involve burning grass, harassing guerrilla tactics, burning supply trains. But if the Army advanced beyond Fort Bridger or tried to attempt, or if they attempted to enter Salt Lake Valley from the north, Nauvoo Legion officers were ordered to pitch into officers and pickets and among them all you can. So Mormon soldiers, while they were told not to shed blood before that point, were told to attack. This confrontation, the miracle of it, is that there was so little bloodshed because it came that close in a number of times.
The Mormon forces under Daniel Wells, under Lott Smith, they were good at this. They raised a lot of havoc.
These young Mormon kids had been raised on the frontier. A lot of observers looked at them and said, these kids are wild as Indians. And they were born on horses. They knew the terrain intimately. And the Army was a big, fat, dumb target, partly because, although General Harney had some notions the Mormons would resist. The officers in command of the advance did not anticipate resistance. They could not imagine that American citizens would come out and burn Army supply trains. They just were completely flummoxed by this guerrilla strategy.
Well, there are some pretty good stories from all of this. one story that I heard, the Mormon forces scattered the livestock, among them the mules of these U.S. military forces. And then they called bugle the U.S. forces to bring the mules back. That story. It's pretty good.
Well, this happens at South Pass, and it involves Orrin Porter Rockwell, the man of God, son of thunder. And Port takes his boys up as a colonel in the militia and leads a raid on the 10th Infantry, I believe, and gets in, and they've all dismounted. And they go in, they run off the cattle, and one of the infantry officers has the presence to sound stable call. And when mules heard stable call, it meant, soup's on, food!
Right.
So the lead belled mule turns around, and all of his buddies turn around, and there go all of the Mormons' horses with him. So Port and his friends have to walk away, and they eventually are able to acquire other horses.
David Bickler.
One of the most impressive things to me is their use of intelligence. They knew, Daniel Wells knew what U.S. officers were going to do almost as soon as they decided to do it, and he responded to it very quickly. He had no military training, no military background at all, but he out-generaled the best the U.S. Army had at the time.
Yes, Richard Charlie.
I might just add, too, that one of the disadvantages the U.S. Army had at the time was that most of the troops were infantry.
Yeah.
They lacked the horsepower, literally, that they needed to fight an effective war against this type of effort.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's see. Matt is with us in Linden, Utah. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
First of all, let me say it's great to hear such a diverse group among your guests today and the differing perspectives. My question is, to what extent did – and this is maybe directed mostly to Will Bagley. To what extent did Brigham Young incite the people against the government in the same way some have claimed he incited them against the wagon train in southern Utah? And it just maybe have some of your comment on that. And then also, with the recent views, new views toward the Utah war, is it an accurate statement to say that this idea that this was an heroic struggle against the U.S. government and that the saints somehow prevailed, is that sort of gone the way of old history?
Well, thanks very much. Glad you called. Two questions there. First of all, Will Bagley, and perhaps Richard Turley, you can respond as well. What is the relationship between the Utah War and the events leading up to the Mountain Meadows disaster?
A lot of it comes to how you interpret Brigham Young's actions. It's essential to understanding Brigham Young's behavior at this point to realize how traumatized he'd been by the murder of Joseph Smith. Smith was in the custody of the governor of Illinois, and the fact that he was then murdered by a renegade militia always said to Brigham Young that he was at risk personally. That if the Army got a hold of him, and he repeats this again and again, they would hang him without a trial. So he feels this personal threat. But he also feels that the entire people are threatened. What he does in denouncing the Army and stirring up this war fever is based on propaganda. It's not true. The Army did not attack Mormon wagon trains. The Army fed Mormon handcart trains that had run out of food in the Sweetwater River. The Army was a professional military institution. And Young, I believe, has to be held accountable for creating this hysteria. Now, the question on what was his policy? I believe his war policy was to shut down the Overland Road. That was one of the only political cards he could play against the government. He may or may not have believed his own rhetoric about how 10,000, one man would defeat 10,000. One righteous Mormon would defeat 10,000 in the army. But he did know that if he shut down the Transcontinental Wagon Road, it would create a furor in the United States. And he was right. Now, my take on it is that it tied into his desire to avenge Joseph Smith, and that he wanted to create an incident that would show that the Mormons controlled that road. And Mountain Meadows, I believe, was the outcome of implementing that policy.
Well, Richard Turley, you're not in agreement with that idea, but Brigham Young's, the trauma of losing his beloved leader, Joseph Smith, does that play into any of this, Utah War or Mountain Meadows?
First of all, on Mountain Meadows, I will say that Mountain Meadows was a war crime, and I'll just refer people to my forthcoming book on that. But as far as whether Brigham Young was upset at the death of Joseph Smith and whether that had an impact on the war, I think most certainly. When Brigham Young saw that Joseph Smith and his brother Hiram were murdered, and then despite the fact that the murderers were well known and notorious, no one was ever convicted for the crime, he saw that persecuted minorities, Latter-day Saints, would not get justice in the United States. And when he left the United States hoping to find a place where the saints would not be persecuted and came west, he came here with that experience of multiple encounters with soldiers. And so when the soldiers came, he did get exercised about that. But it was not something that came of no experience. The saints did have experiences three times facing soldiers, and so they knew what soldiers could do.
I think you're mixing up militia who were disorganized, not uniformed, who were essentially, as the Mormons characterized them, often mobs. Certainly the militia in Missouri was very much of a mob. And the actions in Illinois were not by generally organized state militia. The contact the U.S. had had with the actual U.S. Army had been mixed. But, in fact, Americans had served in the U.S. Army and the Mormon Battalion. The U.S. Army itself had generally played very straight with the Mormons. And I think that their fear of a mob expresses their memories of what they'd experienced. But I think that to make the Army the target that Brigham Young did was unfair. I won't say unpatriotic, but I would say unfair.
But Doug, there was an experience several years earlier with Colonel Steptoe's soldiers who had taken certain advantages with some of the Mormon ladies, which I think did play yes. into this. But also the flip side of that is the federal officials come in and they try to impose the common law, which was completely repudiated by Brigham Young and the legislature. So I think this is really a two-sided and probably even a multi-sided story.
And we'll have a paper on the Steptoe expedition by Bill McKinney.
Richard Turley, your take finally?
Well, I was going to say that there were also statements made by the soldiers to passing Mormons that suggested that they were going to come in and pillage and rob and so forth. The soldiers
Correct.
May have been saying that as much to have fun with these people they probably knew were spies. But nevertheless, those rumors took on a life of their own and helped with the perception here in Utah.
Let's go back to the phone. Eric is with us in Orem. Eric, welcome.
Well, yes, hello.
Yes.
My question is there any truth to the idea of a suicide pact Brigham Young had with the Saints on the approach of Johnson's army? This is something I've been discussing with my friends, that they were out in the West Desert, and they were, if Johnson's army arrived, that they would effectively commit suicide.
No.
So David Bigler, do you take this? They were going to burn down the town if the U.S. soldiers fell out of rank. But were they going to kill themselves? Was that ever part of a plan that you've heard of?
The simple answer to that is just no, they were not. One point I'd like to comment on that hasn't been touched on yet, and that is great emphasis has been given to the Mormon military response to the army coming. But little has been given to Brigham Young's closure of the Overland Trails. Utah Territory at that time ran from central Colorado, the Rocky Mountains, to the Sierra Nevada. And when you close down an area large enough to encompass New England, New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, you cut a nation of 33 million people in half, and you make conflict certain, you make bloodshed certain, if you don't eventually back down or move out of the way.
Mark is with us, calling from Provo. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Doug. I've got a question for your guests. And I grew up Mormon, and I'm wondering why. Well, I know my own ignorance is part of it, but I'm wondering why these incidents aren't really taught in church. Like, does that make sense? The Mountain Meadow Massacre, I just learned about that last year. I'm wondering if your guests could provide any insight as to that.
Okay. Mark, glad you called. Richard Turley?
Well, I think that the reason you don't hear a lot about this in church is that there's not a lot about it that's edifying. The Mountain Meadows Massacre is certainly the worst moment in Latter-day Saint history. The Utah War is a matter that does get some attention in the schools.
Not much time left. Gerald sends this email, and he makes a very good point. He says the most commonly propagated local fiction is that the Utah War was bloodless. It depends, he writes, on what you call bloodless. While there were no real battles, hundreds of federal troops died during the conflict, mostly from disease and the consequences of the winter encampment at Fort Bridger. So you have a point, David Bigler, that it wasn't bloodless? Yeah, there weren't many bullets flying.
Pretty hard to move that many people around without and armed men confronting each other on such a large scale without having somebody get killed. But there were no pitched battles. And there are no doubt some who died in camp of disease and other causes. But the miracle of the Utah War was that there were no pitched open battles. If there had have been, if American troops had been killed in battle by Mormon troops, or Mormon troops had been killed in battle by U.S. Army troops,
it would have been like lighting a match to a flame.
It would have been a very bad thing.
I think we could all heartily agree that had the Utah War been ignited by a single incident of violence, the killing of an American soldier, it would have been a religious civil war. Utah would look a lot like Afghanistan. And I've often said if we had fought the Utah War, I'd still be up in the hills fighting it.
Let me ask you this finally, and I'll remind you, we have 1 minute for all of you to say this. Who won the Utah War? Too simple-minded a question? David?
Over the long run, I think the United States won, as Rick Turley has pointed out, and I think the church won, too. That didn't end the confrontation between these two forms of government. It went on a lower level for 30 more years. But eventually, President Wilford Woodruff brought it to an end. And so the old theocracy that existed here in the 19th century no longer exists. He introduced a new day and a time of growth and really a church and its people who become known throughout the country for their patriotism, for their civic-mindedness, and for their citizenship.
Michael, final word?
Yes, I believe it was only the first battle in a much longer war. And what it did is it established the principle of trying to avoid bloodshed, at which I think both the federal government and the LDS Church were able to be successful at until the manifesto in 1890.
Will, 20 seconds.
As Jane Richards, the wife of an apostle, said, after the army showed up, Salt Lake was never the same. And I'd go with the consensus that the people of Utah won this.
And Richard Turley, finally.
Likewise, I think the people that Utah won, America won, everyone won in this one.
Richard Turley, he's assistant historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Michael Homer is chair of the Utah State Board of History. We were also joined by historians Will Bagley and David Bigler. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.